Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, February 20, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on civil asset forfeiture. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Practice Group's Associate Director at the Federalist Society. And as always, I want to remind everyone that the expressions of opinion are those of our experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And today, we're pleased to welcome our experts, John Malcolm, who is the Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Mr. John Vardaman, who is the Assistant Deputy Chief of the Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering Section of the United States Department of Justice. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. Mr. Malcolm, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, David, and I'd like to thank the Federalist Society and also John Vardaman for agreeing to participate in this discussion with me. So in the few minutes that I have for opening remarks, I thought I would talk about how civil forfeiture, despite its good intentions, has gone awry and why it's in need of reform, which I, by the way, believe is inevitable. Civil asset forfeiture is based on a fiction, albeit one of ancient lineage, that property can be guilty of a crime and forfeited to the sovereign, regardless of whether any individual is ever charged with, much less convicted of, a crime. Civil asset forfeiture has a laudable goal, to deprive criminals of the fruits of their labor. Unfortunately, as I will describe in a few moments, the procedures used are skewed against innocent property owners. Moreover, what began as a means to an admirable end has, in many instances, become the end itself, where law enforcement authorities focus more on getting money and property and less on actually catching criminals. Police and prosecutors end up having a substantial budgetary stake in forfeiture because in most cases the proceeds from any forfeited property are returned to the agency that seized it for its use, thereby providing them with a direct funding mechanism that is totally outside the legislative oversight and appropriations process. Now, in our country, the roots of civil forfeiture come from admiralty and customs law, where ships carrying contraband on the high seas were seized and forfeited. And it was not until 1984, with the passage of the Comprehensive Crime Control Act and the War on Drugs, that civil forfeiture really began to grow dramatically. Today, there are, I believe, more than 400 forfeiture laws covering a whole panoply of federal crimes. The types of property that can be forfeited are property used to commit a crime, so-called facilitating property, the proceeds of crime, or the fruits of a crime, or property bought with the proceeds of crime, so-called substitute assets. The federal government also operates an equitable sharing program, which I will discuss shortly, that has dramatically expanded the scope of civil asset forfeiture. Civil asset forfeiture differs from criminal forfeiture in several significant ways. In a criminal forfeiture case, the government sets out the property that is subject to forfeiture as part of the indictment that also includes charges against the individuals who used or obtained the property. And the forfeiture proceeding is an ancillary proceeding that follows the defendant's being convicted. A civil forfeiture proceeding, on the other hand, is an in rem proceeding against the property only and doesn't involve any formal charges of wrongdoing against any individuals at all. One of the main criticisms against civil asset forfeiture is that the deck is stacked against any property owner who wishes to contest the forfeiture. Because the legal proceeding is against the property, not the property owner, the owner does not enjoy many of the constitutional protections that are afforded to those accused of engaging in criminal activity. First of all, the vast majority of cases never see the inside of a courtroom. I believe it's roughly 80% of forfeiture proceedings are handled administratively. Any amount of currency can be administratively forfeited, and the only time administrative forfeiture is not available is if the forfeiture involves any real property or personal property worth more than $500,000. In an administrative proceeding, the agency that stands to gain directly from the forfeiture acts as investigator, prosecutor, judge, and jury. The rules and deadlines governing these proceedings are also complicated and opaque, with lots of traps along the way for an unwary property owner. Second, unlike a criminal case, there's no entitlement to representation by counsel or a right to a preliminary hearing or a speedy trial. Forfeitures are often for a small enough amount that it makes no financial sense for a property owner to go out and hire counsel to contest the forfeiture. forfeiture cases can also take months or years, effectively tying up somebody's property, which can create an extreme hardship for people of modest means or people who run small businesses. Third, unlike a criminal case where a prosecutor has to prove a defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, in a civil forfeiture case, the prosecutor only needs to establish the basis for the forfeiture by a preponderance of the evidence. And fourth, unlike a criminal case where the prosecutor has to prove that the person who used or derived the property acted intentionally or at least was willfully blind to its misuse, in a civil case, the government doesn't have to prove any of that. Rather, the burden is placed on the innocent owner to prove a negative, that he did not know about its illegal use, and that if he did know about it, he did all that that could reasonably be expected under the circumstances to terminate such use. The amounts of money that we are talking about here are huge and have grown exponentially. Many federal agencies within the Justice Department and the Treasury Department participate in and administer their own forfeiture programs, including ATF, DEA, FBI, the Postal Inspection Service, the Marshal Service, the IRS, ICE, Customs and Border Patrol, and other agencies. The Department of Justice has the largest asset forfeiture fund. In 1985, the first year of its existence, that fund took in $27 million. In 2012, the value of seized assets had grown to $4.3 billion. Many states, by the way, have their own forfeiture proceedings or programs, but they do not collect or publish such data. 26 states allow law enforcement authorities to keep 100% of the forfeiture proceeds, just as federal authorities are allowed to keep all of the proceeds that they receive under federal law. Only 8 states bar state and local authorities from using forfeiture funds, and the rest allow state and local authorities to keep somewhere between 50% and 95% of forfeiture proceeds. Federal authorities frequently adopt state cases and institute federal forfeiture proceedings. When they do, federal authorities can, and frequently do, return up to 80% of the proceeds to state and local authorities as part of an equitable sharing program. Equitable sharing represents serious money. In 2013, DOJ paid out $657 million to state and local authorities through the Equitable Sharing Program, and since 1984, more than $5 billion has been dispersed under this program. Many local authorities prefer to have federal authorities handle forfeiture matters, in part because the Equitable Sharing Program enables them to circumvent state laws that make forfeitures more difficult or less profitable. Unfortunately, the financial incentives to seize cash and valuable property are so high that it sometimes warps the priorities of many local law enforcement officials. For example, authorities have been known to let the bad guys commit their crimes just so they can seize the cash that they earn from those crimes. And even though there is a federal ban on the use of equitably shared forfeiture funds to pay salaries and otherwise support budgets, hundreds of law enforcement agencies rely on such funds as part, sometimes a significant part, of their annual budgets. For example, a deputy sheriff in Kane County, Illinois, wrote in a training book, quote, "All of our hometowns are sitting on a tax-liberating gold mine." The city attorney of Las Cruces, New Mexico, was caught on videotape telling a room full of people how police officers waited outside a bar, hoping that the owner of a 2008 Mercedes would walk out drunk, because they could hardly wait to get their hands on his car. A Metro Gang strike force in Minnesota, which was under investigation by state and federal authorities for abusive forfeiture practices, was forced to shut down and pay out $840 million in settlements. Highway stops have become a particularly big problem. In Tennessee, a local news investigation revealed the drug task force officers were 10 times more likely to patrol the westbound lanes of I-40 than the eastbound lanes. Why? Because it was known that illegal drugs from Mexico were transported into Nashville on the eastbound road, and the couriers would return with the proceeds on the westbound road. The officers would make pretextual stops, search the cars, and seize the cash, usually by alleging that it was likely connected to drugs. But rather than arrest the drivers, officers would often have them sign a waiver to the funds on the side of the road and then let them go. The same thing, by the way, was happening and may still be happening in Volusia County, Florida, Tenaha, Texas, and in other locations. Authorities have been known to threaten to arrest and charge drivers and passengers with committing crimes, even though no drugs were found during the search, or to turn over any children in the car to protective services, unless the people in the car agreed to sign away their rights to the cash on the spot. And it's not just highway stops. The IRS and other agencies have seized and forfeited bank accounts of individuals and small businesses from dozens of dairy farmers in Maryland and from people like Carol Hinders, who owned and operated a restaurant called Mrs. Lady's Mexican Food in Spirit Lake, Iowa for a number of years, for alleged structuring violations. Even though the authorities have no reason whatsoever to believe that the money in those accounts was derived from illegal activity, and even though there are lots of legitimate and sensible reasons why businesses make regular cash deposits under $10,000. And some of the seizures seem to be wildly disproportionate and unfair in relation to the alleged offense. In Detroit, Michigan, for example, authorities raided a funk night event at the Contemporary Art Museum and seized 44 cars from 130 attendees, on the theory that the attendees were somehow responsible for the fact that the organizer of the event had failed to obtain a permit to serve alcohol and that the cars had been used to transport them to that event. In Philadelphia, several homeowners, some quite elderly, are fighting to keep their primary residences after family members, children, or grandchildren engage in small narcotics transactions on the premises with undercover officers. And not surprisingly, with no real accountability, enforcement officials sometimes spend forfeiture funds in highly questionable ways. In Georgia, the Fulton County District Attorney purchased sports tickets, paid for office parties, made donations to a lawyer's group that later inducted him into its Hall of Fame, and paid for a personal home security system for his private residence out of forfeiture funds. The former sheriff in Camden County, Georgia, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on forfeiture funds on things like renovations for his weekend home and a large donation to his alma mater to establish a scholarship in his name. A district attorney in Texas distributed more than $1 million in forfeiture funds to favored employees. Authorities have purchased margarita machines, funded lavish training trips, and in one instance purchased a Zamboni machine with forfeiture funds. A DOJ IG audit of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol found that $1.9 million out of $3.4 million over a three-year period was in unallowable and unsupported expenditures, including salaries, overtime pay, and construction. And a recent IG report similarly disallowed $374,257 in questionable expenditures by officials in Sunrise, Florida. Now, there have been some positive developments recently that may help ameliorate some of these abuses. For instance, the IRS recently announced that it would no longer seek forfeitures in structuring cases unless it has evidence that the business or individual making the deposits was engaged in criminal activity. However, the IRS announced that it was not dropping any of its pending structuring cases, and of course, other agencies still reserve the right to bring structuring cases without such evidence. Moreover, this is, of course, only a policy change, which can be reversed at any time. More significantly, on January 16th, Attorney General Eric Holder announced a new policy limiting when agency participants in equitable sharing program can adopt cases involving assets seized by state or local authorities under state law. He stated that this was part of a top-to-bottom review being undertaken by DOJ of its civil asset forfeiture program. Of course, this too is only a policy change, which can be reversed at any time. Although I am cautiously optimistic, it remains to be seen how much of an impact DOJ's new policy will have, since there are several exceptions to this new policy that threaten, at least potentially, to swallow the rule. The policy will still allow for equitable sharing in cases generated from federal and state task forces, which, according to a 2012 GAO report, constitutes about 83% of equitable sharing cases. The policy will still allow adoption when federal authorities obtain a federal seizure warrant, which is not a terribly difficult thing to do. The policy contains a public safety exception when seizures involve firearms, ammunition, explosives, and other property related to child pornography. And there is a catch-all provision that allows for adoptive seizures based on the sole discretion of the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division. Despite DOJ's efforts to stave off action by Congress, there appears to be a great deal of bipartisan support for reform. The FAIR Act, which stands for Fifth Amendment Integrity Resolution, was recently introduced by Senator Rand Paul and Congressman Tim Walberg. That act would address a number of the issues that I've been discussing, and I'm happy to get into the details during the Q&A if anybody is interested. I would say, though, that I think it is highly likely that this legislation is going to get very serious consideration, as both Senator Grassley and Congressman Goodlatte, who chair the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, have made it quite clear that they consider this issue to be a high priority. And with that, I think I will stop and turn it over to John Vardaman, and I look forward to hearing his comments.
Thank you, John, and thanks also to the Federalist Society for hosting this important forum. I'm glad to have the opportunity to address forfeiture, civil forfeiture in particular, which has obviously been getting a lot of attention recently. I'd like to talk about sort of a couple sort of the underlying principles of civil forfeiture, which I think often get lost in sort of, you know, the avalanche of anecdotal evidence that taken together paint a pretty ugly picture. But I think it's important, and obviously I can't go through and rebut and address every single instance that John has highlighted. Some of those are well known to us, and, you know, suffice it to say, there's often more to the story than some of these sensationalized stories. But that aside, I think it's important to take a step back, talk a little bit about why civil forfeiture is such an important tool, the protections that are in place to protect innocent owners, the fact that this is an invaluable resource for returning money to victims, to talk about some of the misconceptions that have unfortunately taken hold of late, and also some of the efforts that we are undertaking internally at the department. I won't get into sort of the background of civil forfeiture and from whence it began. I think John did a good job of that, but I think that the sort of the why of civil forfeiture is important. First of all, I think it's a recognition that when a crime is committed, the government has an interest not only in the prosecution of the criminal, but in removing the criminally tainted assets from circulation, and when possible, returning those to victims. And in many cases, civil forfeiture is the best, if not the only, mechanism by which to do that. Civil forfeiture is also a recognition that criminals are sophisticated and often intentionally create distance between themselves and the proceeds and the tools of their crimes. What that means is that while ideally we would be able to prosecute the criminal in possession of the assets that was derived from their crimes, that is often not the case. Oftentimes criminals cannot be prosecuted. And then we're left with the assets, and in the absence of a prosecution, we would be unable to remove those tainted assets from circulation. There are any number of scenarios in which this is the case. You have drug organizations in which obviously the drug dealers create space and have individuals who weren't involved in the underlying crime who are moving the money. You have fugitives and international criminals for whom we don't have jurisdiction but who have assets in the United States. This is everything from fugitives who have left the United States or fled the United States, international terrorists who have assets in the United States for whom we can't criminally prosecute, instances in which a criminal defendant dies before the proceedings have concluded. This is what happened in the Ken Lay proceeding. Without civil forfeiture, we would not have been able to forfeit his criminal proceeds and return those to victims. So there are a whole host of scenarios in which civil forfeiture is necessary to perform a compelling government interest in removing these assets from circulation. I would just touch on a couple things in terms of what I would call some of the misconceptions. I think it might be useful to, I'm going to quote from an article in a prominent newspaper describing some of this very same incidents which John mentioned in trying to describe the alleged abuses of civil forfeiture, not only in practice, but sort of in essence. And this is how it's described. It says, civil assets of forfeiture is one of the most powerful and unusual law enforcement tools. Police do not need evidence of a crime to use it. because it is a civil action against an object, such as currency or a car, rather than a person. As a consequence, protections common in criminal law do not apply. In fact, the burden is on the owners who want to recover their cash or property in order for it not to be, in order to prove it is not tied to a crime. So what does this suggest? This suggests that law enforcement can, with absolutely no evidence of criminality, seize an asset. And upon that, the burden is then on the individual to come and recover that asset. Both of those premises are incorrect. They sort of represent a fundamental criticism of civil forfeiture. But first and foremost, law enforcement cannot seize an asset in the absence of probable cause that it's tied to criminality. More often than not, this is done pursuant to a judicially issued warrant. But oftentimes, it occurs in the absence of a warrant under exceptions to the warrant requirement. But the main point is that a seizure for forfeiture cannot occur in the absence of probable cause that is linked to a crime. So this notion that cops or law enforcement are out just arbitrarily seizing assets that they might be attractive to them for future use without any nexus to crime is just erroneous. Secondly, once the civil forfeiture proceeding is initiated, it is the government's burden to link that property to a crime. It is not the burden of the individual to prove to show otherwise. The government must show by preponderance of the evidence that the asset in question is linked to a criminal activity. Once they've done that, they have proved forfeitability. But the law provides for an innocent owner to come in and assert that notwithstanding the fact that this is a crime that has been linked to criminal activity, which is not an insignificant showing, the law still provides an opportunity for those individuals to demonstrate that notwithstanding the government showing that they should still be entitled to the asset because they are an innocent owner. And if they do prevail in that instance, they not only get their asset returned to them, but they are awarded attorney's fees. And then I would also just touch upon this notion again that it's you often hear this in the media and sometimes in Congress that civil forfeiture is somehow inherently illegitimate because there's not an accompanying criminal conviction. And again, this gets to the very heart of why civil forfeiture is necessary. There are often times when a criminal conviction is not possible. And so to conflate those two is really to sort of misrepresent what civil forfeiture is about. John has touched on a number of other things that I'd be happy to get into from sort of a broader perspective. I mean, one is, you know, a lot of these anecdotes that he cited didn't distinguish between whether or not a forfeiture occurred pursuant to state or federal law, which is a very important distinction because state and federal law are not always the same. Obviously, for the Department of Justice, we can only speak to federal forfeiture laws and practices. The equitable sharing program, structuring, the adoption policy, I'm happy to talk about all of these. Again, to talk about why they're necessary. Why are these laws in place? Why are these policies and practices in place? It's easy to cite abuses and to try and discredit them, but I think it's important to take a step back and understand why are structuring laws in place? Why do we have an equitable sharing program? You mentioned our recently announced policy on adoptions. I think that's a great example of the department recognizing that, as we always do, and we're always looking for ways to improve this program, that was an area where improvement was needed and necessary. We took the steps to do it. I'd be happy to talk about the policy itself and why we don't think that the exceptions or the loopholes undermine the aim of the policy. And also just that this is part of an ongoing review. You know, we are staunch defenders of this policy and this program, but we, of course, are not unaware of the fact that there are these concerns and criticisms, and we take them seriously. And where we do feel like there is room for improvement, we are willing to take action as the adoption policy evidences. And also, you also mentioned the FAIR Act. That's something that the department has been considering, would be happy to talk about that as well. But I guess just on a general matter, I would just like everyone to understand that there are legitimate, compelling law enforcement reasons for civil forfeiture. There are protections in place. This is a program that we take very seriously because we know it's a powerful tool, and we think we use it effectively and efficiently and appropriately. And again, this is, I can't underscore this enough, this is oftentimes the only way that we have to take assets out of circulation and return them to victims. In the past, since 2000, the department has returned over $4 billion to victims of crime, almost half of which was done through civil forfeiture. If civil forfeiture is abolished, or if the burdens are made too onerous, that means not only are criminal instrumentalities and proceeds going to remain in circulation and be used by future criminals, but it also means that victims of crime will not be able to recover their losses. So with that, I will turn it back over or open it up to questions.
Can I briefly respond, David, before we get to questions? Just a couple of quick points.
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. So the first thing is that John says is, well, the authorities need probable cause in order to seize this, seize the material. If it's done pursuant to warrant, that's one thing. A lot of times, particularly highway stops, it's not done pursuant to a warrant. I would say, look, there are a lot of honorable law enforcement agents, both federal and state, but at the state level, it's quite obvious that the temptations to seize assets have become so great that really these highway stops have become nothing more than a shakedown in which probable cause is lacking and is frankly never tested in front of a magistrate, judge, or a court of any kind. John is, of course, correct that the government does have to establish a link between the property and the crime, but it only has to do so by a preponderance of the evidence, which is not a terribly difficult thing to do, and then the burden really is put on the owner to prove that he is innocent and not guilty, which I think is unfair. And I would say, even with respect to things like structuring offenses, while there may be laudable reasons to do with structuring offenses when you think you have things like drug couriers, that the temptation to seize assets has been so great that the department and certainly state authorities have used that authority very unwisely to go after legitimate innocent owners. And I would say that this is an instance in when the tool that you have is a hammer, that everything starts to look like a nail. And so, again, something that began with the best of intentions, that occasionally does have admirable uses, has been abused so much that it's in need of reform. And I don't believe necessarily in legislating by anecdotes, but in this case, there are so many examples of this that the problems are undeniable. With that, I'm prepared. We can get to questions.
And just briefly, if I really quickly, because this is a couple of very important points that John has touched upon, the preponderance of the evidence standard. It's often said that the standard is too low. Well, this is a standard that's common across the board in civil proceedings. So it's not as if that this is an unusually or unduly low standard for forfeiture. Quite the contrary. This is the standard that applies across the board in civil proceedings. Raising this to clear and convincing evidence, as the FAIR Act would do, would be a huge departure from that common standard. And, that's a standard that's used only in sort of extraordinary circumstances, like trying to take a child away from a parent. So, when I hear that the standard is preponderance of the evidence, well, that's the same as it is in any other civil proceeding. And just real quickly on the issue of structuring and the idea of an innocent owner, structuring is predicated on the idea that if you structure transactions in such a way to deprive or to prevent a financial institution from reporting records with the government, which are very important for law enforcement purposes, there's no prerequisite that those assets be criminally tainted assets. If we can show that there was an intent to structure, that is a crime in and of itself. Congress has so made it. So when we're talking about innocent parties, I think it's important to realize that Congress has specifically allowed for structuring violations even in the absence of an underlying criminal violation, other criminal law violation.
We will now move on to the Q&A portion of the call.
Yes, hi, I'm Chris Garvey from the Libertarian Party. I'd like to point out, before I ask my question, that most of the crimes by taking this money are victimless crimes. And I'd like to ask the anti-civil asset forfeiture speaker here, Mr. Malcolm, if he's aware of the Downsize DC dot campaigns, one of which is directed at ending civil asset forfeiture, and another one is directed at ending the war on drugs, which would get rid of an awful lot of the excuses for this Fifth Amendment abuse.
Well, I'm aware that that Washington, D.C. recently amended their forfeiture laws in admirable ways. I think they're not alone in that regard. A few other states have done so, Minnesota being quite prominent. And I know that that is most likely going to effectively end the equitable sharing program with D.C. Officials. You know, with respect to what you say about the war on drugs, I'm certainly aware of the fact, since I live inside the district, that D.C. voters...
Let me clarify my question. There's an organization called DownsizeDC.org, and it's a national organization, and it enables you to go online and click on their campaigns button, or you go to DownsizeDC.org/ETP, which stands for Educate the Powerful. And you'll see these campaigns, a whole list of them, of things that you can easily write your congressmen and senators with just one page, and it'll use their email forms instead of having to wade through the nonsense that my senator puts you through. And send a letter to your senators and your congressmen. And they have two campaigns directly aimed at these problems. One is the End Civil Asset Forfeiture campaign. So you could write a letter saying to support Rand Paul's bill, and the other one simply says end the war on drugs, and you can put whatever you want in there. And you mentioned civil asset forfeiture, and thereby it's an easier way to let your federal legislators know that you're against civil asset forfeiture.
Well, the short answer to your question is I'm not aware of that particular campaign, although it does not surprise me knowing D.C. politics, and I also am aware of other similar moves afoot in other states.
DownsizeDC.org. It's not just directed at D.C., it's a federal thing.
Okay. David, do we have another question?
Yeah, I'll move on to our next participant.
Hi, Steve Klein from the Wyoming Liberty Group out here in Cheyenne. Really appreciate the teleforum, and we're out here in the middle of a rather heated battle right now on civil forfeiture reform. A bill passed the Wyoming legislature this week overwhelmingly, but was then vetoed by Governor Meade, his first non-budget veto in his five-year tenure so far. So I guess I would throw that out to Mr. Malcolm. What's the... You mentioned at the beginning, you kind of said reform is inevitable. And
right.
After the going through what we're going through out here, we're in a state where forfeiture, it's an abusive law, to be sure, but the law, you know, we haven't seen anything like they saw in Tennessee or in some of the more controversial states, and it's never really been a super supplement to police budgeting and the like. But nevertheless, opposition by law enforcement and prosecutors is overwhelmingly strong, and I should add, quite negative. So I'm curious where you go with that.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking that question, and let me clarify when I talked about reform is inevitable. I think that reform is inevitable of some kind at the federal level. I just think that, you know, there are enough influential people in both parties that have seen these abuses and want to take action that I think is going to happen. And I think it will be some manifestation of the FAIR Act, although it's just been introduced, so I don't know how that's going to play itself out. At the state and local level, local sheriffs and police departments view this is only slightly hyperbolic, as an existential threat. And, you know, look, I if these funds were put into the general treasury of the states, they could go to the state legislatures and the governor and could lobby, just like people who support education reform or you know, whatever other competing interests there are for tax dollars can do that. But I do think that there's an awful lot of pressure whenever one of these bills comes up at the state level by prosecutors and by sheriffs to allow these sort of off-book supplements to their budget to continue. And there are some states that have been quite bold. Missouri, for instance, has said all forfeiture funds are supposed to go into a special education fund. Minnesota now requires a criminal conviction before civil forfeiture proceedings can be begun. That is not something, by the way, that's required by the FAIR Act. But I think that it's a lot harder to do at the state level precisely for the reasons that you identified. But I do think that there's going to be something that will happen at the federal level.
Thank you.
Okay, we will move on to our next person.
Yes, this is Mark Gibson from Wichita Falls, Texas. I'm a retired U.S. Army officer and member of the Federalist Society. I have a comment for Mr. Vardaman. Sir, while I understand the original intent of civil asset forfeiture, that's something that Americans, you know, can and probably do support. I would submit to you that this intent and purpose has been so lost in the eyes of the public and now by various legislatures that the process has been discredited, I think, beyond repair. And I would like to hear you speak to that.
Sure. I think that you know, as I tried to highlight by quoting from that article, I think one of the reasons why you know, there has been you know, civil forfeiture has been subject to so much criticism is a sort of a misunderstanding. You talked about the original intent. Well, I think that intent is as necessary today as it was originally, and in fact, this gets to a point from one of the original questioners about the number of crimes being the majority of victimless crimes. Mm-hmm. Well, that may have been true at the outset of the program in the 80s, but well over half of the crimes that result in civil forfeiture now are crimes involving fraud. And so I think that's an area where, what that means is that we are able to forfeit fraud proceeds and return them back to the victims of the fraud. And that is an aspect of this program which has grown tremendously. And so you have to understand that in the absence of civil forfeiture, oftentimes we would be wholly unable to remove those assets and those proceeds and return them back to victims. So I think, and coupled with the fact that I think so much of this reporting has been based on misconceptions, again, leaving the impression that law enforcement can simply seize assets without any probable cause, that the owner or the property is considered guilty until proven innocent. This is just incorrect, and it's as if there's a sort of a feeding frenzy now that I think has resulted in the truth of this being obscured. And you even see it, frankly, from members of Congress who are repeating a lot of these misconceptions. And just finally, the idea that somehow this entire civil forfeiture is tainted by virtue of equitable sharing and there being this perceived incentive. You also have to understand that equitable sharing, and again, that refers to money going back out to state and local law enforcement that participated in a seizure, only takes place at the very end of a proceeding and when victims, if there are victims of the case, have received their money or have been compensated for their losses and all of the federal costs and resources have been compensated. So it's not as if equitable sharing occurs in every case. Victims come before equitable sharing, and in many cases, law enforcement receive nothing from participating in these cases.
Yes, if sir. I could respond briefly, I really don't think, with all due respect to John's comments, I don't actually think that these are perceptions. In theory, he is right that you need to have probable cause to seize goods. But the reality is that at the state level, these law enforcement officials like the candy. So they have now they're applying forfeiture to more and more laws. If you are a drunk driver or a drunk boater, or if you use your car to try to solicit a prostitute, or if a grandson sells a dime bag on the porch of a house, and they then grab the stuff, and a lot of times there is no judicial oversight at all. People are threatened with prosecution unless they sign away their rights. They sign away their rights and they move on down the road, even if there is, frankly, no probable cause. And with respect to, you know, property owners having to be guilty until proven innocent, yes, the government's got to come forward and put some evidence on that shows that there's that this property, there was some connection between this property and a crime. But if somebody is an absentee landlord, or if they have a legitimate business, even if they have a legitimate reason to make regular deposits under $10,000, they bear the burden of hiring an attorney, jumping through all of these procedural hoops, and then having to come in to justify why their property shouldn't be taken. Now, you can say that these are misconceptions because, in theory, probable cause needs to be there, and because the government has to first establish a connection between the property and the crime. But I would say that the overall picture that this paints is not a misconception.
Yes, sir. Mr. Malcolm, can you still hear me?
I can.
Great. If I could, I just have a very brief question for you, and I'll defer to everyone else. But I know that there's been a lot of discussion recently in Congress about this very issue. There are folks coming out saying that things have to change, et cetera. My question to you, Mr. Malcolm, would be: would congressional legislation, do you think, be comprehensive enough to be able to reach down into state jurisdiction and take care of the issue, or is this going to have to be something that's going to a test case is going to have to go into the federal courts? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not even sure it will go into the federal courts. The mm-hmm. states have their own forfeiture programs, and unfortunately, whatever Congress is going to do would touch only on federal forfeiture proceedings. There are a lot of abusive state proceedings where this would make a big difference, I think. Particularly if the FAIR Act, which calls for an abolition of the equitable sharing program, is that those few states that have already undertaken reform, there will be some bite because state authorities will no longer be able to bypass those state laws by going to federal authorities, getting the forfeiture, and getting the equitable fund, getting the equitably shared funds deposited directly into their accounts. But ultimately, in terms of real reform, that's correct. That is correct.
Okay.
States are going to have to take up this issue.
Well, thank you so much.
We will move on now to our next question. We do still have a few in the queue.
Hello, my name is Diana Pepitone. I'm a member of the Federalist Society, and thank you both for the presentations on the history, background, and statistics related to the civil asset forfeiture question. The question I had has to do with whether the statistics show or the research shows that the impetus for this type of activity is simple corruption, or is it found that political intimidation enters the calculus at any in any of the cases, suppression of speech or political harassment, that type of thing, and whether the statistics show any difference between state and federal actions with regard to that, and whether there's been any trends over time.
John, you want to take a stab at that, or would you like me to?
I'm frankly not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand what you mean by political influence either.
No, not influence. I'm sorry. The question is with regard to many of the cases that were stated seem to show, you know, sort of avarice on the part of the
right.
law enforcement, the officer, whoever it is that's enforcing this,
right.
that they seek monetary gain.
Right.
Are there cases where instead you're seeing the political entity using this this methodology as a form of political harassment, suppression of speech, any way to sort of target and silence actors who may have a political point of view that is adverse to those using this methodology?
I'm not aware. That's not to say that they do not exist, but I have not heard of instances where forfeiture laws are being applied to silence governmental critics. Of course, there are those people who think that, you know, all drugs ought to be legalized, and I suppose you could make the argument that any forfeiture proceeding against, you know, an alleged drug dealer, you know, could be a form of political suppression. But I wouldn't put it into that category. I think that a lot of the abuses that you are seeing and hearing about are just plain avarice, because people are making overtime payments and buying, you know, neat equipment. One aspect of this, we've heard discussions about over-militarization. A lot of these big nifty military-like toys are paid for with forfeiture funds. But I think it's more, it's certainly all the instances that I've heard about involve avarice.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, my name is Dennis Chapman. I'm an Army officer in Northern Virginia. I had a comment mainly for Mr. Vardaman. It's been an interesting discussion, Mr. Vardaman. You've emphasized a number of times that one of the benefits of civil forfeiture is the opportunity to make restitution to crime victims, and that's certainly a laudable and legitimate goal. And as applies the preponderance of the evidence standard, one could make a plausible argument that that's most appropriate in that setting. Generally, two private parties that are contending with conflicting claims to some piece of property, usually their claim would be adjudicated by a preponderance of the evidence standard, right? And one could say that maybe the law enforcement agency involved is a disinterested party because they're not getting the assets. But the problem, I think, that falls apart when you're talking about civil assets to be forfeited to the state. And the state, I mean the political entity, not state government necessarily. You as the Department of Justice, I mean you too as the state, right? Okay? Because then you become an interested party. And your incentives are to seize the property. And while you might say, well, you know, preponderance of the evidence, that's the usual standard, true, but what's not usual in civil litigation between private parties, let's say, is the grotesque disparity of power between the parties. If I'm contending with my neighbor in civil court over a piece of property that we have conflicting claims to, there's structural limitations built in to how hard I can fight to take that property from my neighbor. I only have so much money, so much time, I only have so much expertise, right? And, you know, then there's the amount of emotional commitment that each side has to the issue. But when you and the government engage in an action for civil forfeiture, you have, for all practical purposes, unlimited resources, unlimited money, at least as compared to the private citizen, unlimited, vast amounts of manpower, unlimited expertise in how to work the administrative aspects of the system and the judicial aspects of the system. So that the effort is completely stacked against the private party. And I just don't think that the comparison to civil litigation that you've made for to justify preponderance of the evidence standard, at least when the property is going to be forfeit to the state, is really apposite in light of the gross disparity of power that the state can bring to bear to take your property. I wonder what your comments are.
Well, there's a lot there. I guess a couple things. First of all, I would sort of push back on this notion of law enforcement necessarily being an interested party in this idea of imputing avarice on them, when in some instances there may be equitable sharing down the road, but of course they don't know that at the time they're performing their law enforcement stop. So I think to assume that every law enforcement action that results in a forfeiture is because they're an interested party, I think misunderstands the fact that in many cases they're not getting anything out of this. They're just simply performing their law enforcement function. And I think to try and impute bad motive, I think does a disservice to law enforcement. The idea that that they are judge and jury is also not correct. Obviously, a civil forfeiture, like any civil, like any judicial proceeding, is presided over by a judge. And if the state or the law enforcement did not have the requisite probable cause to seize an asset, or if they're unable to meet their burden of showing that that asset is linked to criminality, then they lose the case. And that's not them deciding that. That's a judge and or a jury deciding that. And if they do, in fact, lose the case, then the owner or the claimant is entitled to attorney's fees, which is a feature that's not common in civil proceedings. So I just think, John may push back on this idea of misconceptions, but I think this time and again we see this, that a lot of the criticisms about civil forfeiture are just that, predicated on misconceptions. I think this is another example.
If I could just follow up real quick.
Well, I'd like to be able to make a comment to it, and then if you want to follow up, you can, but I am one of the speakers here today. So I guess my comment was I think it's wrong on a number of levels. I think it's wrong because, first of all, many of these things end up being handled roadside. And even those things that aren't handled roadside, the overwhelming majority of these cases are handled administratively. And there you do have investigator, prosecutor, judge, and jury being handled by the very agency that's going to get the funds. And this is never overseen by a judge. And with respect to agents going, well, they have no interest because the equitable sharing process will only take place when the case is over. I would say, one, they have a track record. They have all received millions of dollars in forfeiture funds, so they got a pretty good idea about whether this is likely to return, end up in funds being returned to them. And the other thing that I would cite is one of the arguments that you hear by local authorities about why it's important to keep asset forfeiture is because otherwise they would have no incentives to go after the assets, which one refutes what you just said in terms of how they view what their incentives are, and two, it's a terrible statement whenever they say that about law enforcement, about how they're only motivated by getting the assets at the end and not by depriving the bad guys of their ill-gotten gains, regardless of whether they get to keep the assets.
We do have a couple more questions in the queue, but I don't want to tax our speakers. Can we squeeze in one more?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Sure.
Okay. Then I guess this next one will be our last question of the day.
Hi, this question is for John Vardaman. My name is Darpana Sheff. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. I wanted to follow up on that last round of questions and basically wonder, you stated the case for why civil forfeiture is necessary, but I'm curious as to why the DOJ maintains that it should receive the proceeds from forfeited property as opposed to it going back to the system before 1984 in which Congress got to decide and appropriately appropriate the money.
I think what you're referring to is the fact that federally forfeited money pursuant to a DOJ investigation goes into the assets forfeiture fund as opposed to the general treasury. And there are a number of important reasons for that. First of all, if the money went into the general treasury, it could not be distributed back to victims. If the only way that we can preserve this money and make it available to victims is to hold it in the assets forfeiture fund. So I think when anyone talks about diverting this money to the treasury, what they need to know is that that would mean that victims of crime would not be able to receive any money that is forfeited by the government. It's also important to know that, you know, running this program can be incredibly expensive. The costs associated with maintaining assets, again, you know, we're talking about forfeiting criminally tainted assets. We're not just talking about cash. Oftentimes we're talking about any number of assets that need to be maintained, that need to be sold, that need to be preserved, that need to be housed, and doing that can cost a significant amount of money. And so part of the reason for having the fund is to fund the program and all the costs that it incurs.
What I would say, Darpana, it's nice to have you on the call. You know, there may be good reasons and good uses to which DOJ could put those funds. There are a lot of agencies and a lot of departments that also have good uses to which those funds could be put. And I have no problem with DOJ going to Congress and lobbying to get its share of some of those funds. However, I think it's fair to say that a large number of the quote-unquote crimes which serve as the basis for the forfeiture are what has been referred to as victimless crimes, and that the amount seized dramatically exceed the amount that it costs to run the program.
Well, I want to thank both of our speakers today, both John Malcolm and John Vardaman. Very quickly, before we close out, I do want to announce our next Teleform call, which will be on Wednesday, February 24th, when Professor Tom Farr and Ms. Tina Ramirez of Hardwired Global will be discussing the Meriem Ibrahim case at 2 o'clock. But I do want to thank our speakers again on behalf of the Federalist Society. I also want to thank our audience, and we welcome your feedback by email. You can email us at info@fed-soc.org, or you can check out our website for additional announcements of additional events. So please do join us on our next call. And until then, everyone, thank you, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.